Thank you very much for coming. I'm John Pomfret, the Outlook editor of The Washington Post, and welcome to another edition of CSIS's programs on China's rise. Several years ago, Nick Lardy compared the United States' economic relationship to China to that of a dope dealer and an addict. Basically, the dope dealer would sell the goods to the Americans who would mainline Chinese microwaves, clothes, etc., and turn around and also give the addict the money with which to consume it. Now, apparently, that relationship is changing. Question is, where is it going? There seems to be a few signposts. Earlier this month, the Construction Bank of China took a big multi-billion-dollar chunk out of Bank of America. Interesting to note that 4 years before that, Bank of America had taken a $3 billion chunk out of the Bank of Construction of China. Funny also to remember that about 12 years ago, that very same bank was considered insolvent, and now the American bank is considered insolvent. Funny how things change. In the mid-1990s, China also seemed to be relatively satisfied with the idea of the United States dollar being the global economy's reserve currency. In March, we have now the China central banker, Zhou Xiaotran, basically launching a broadside against the dollar as playing such a role. Then there's China's $586 billion stimulus package, which arguably, given the size of China's economy, is the biggest stimulus package in the world. Already the Chinese are crowing the success of that package. And could it be that China's economy is somehow more efficient than that of our own? Well, today we have two noted experts to interrogate those questions and other questions as well. First, we have Charles Freeman, who holds the Freeman Chair in China Studies at CSIS. He focuses on the political economy of China and other parts of East Asia and U.S.-China relations. Charles has also served in government as Assistant U.S. Trade Representative for China Affairs. He was integral with the negotiations of China's WTO entry. He's also worked in the Senate. And he's also worked in the private sector, both as a businessman and a business advisor and a lawyer. Secondly, we have Nick Lardy, who is one of the most, if not the most, influential economists when it comes to China. As a reporter in Beijing, I remember sending him numerous emails with extremely silly questions, and I always thanked him for his patience at my idiocy and for explaining China's economy in a way that even a guy like me could understand. Currently, Nick is the senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, and previously he'd worked across the street at the Brookings Institution, and actually I first met him when he was at the Henry Jackson School of International Studies at the University of Washington. Nick is going to start off. He's just returned from a trip to China, and then Charles will follow him after that. So thanks a lot for coming.
Thank you very much, John. I'm going to talk about where the Chinese economy is headed and why, and then conclude with some remarks on U.S.-China economic policy, kind of broad issues, and I think that'll segue to what Charles is going to cover, which is also a bit on the policy side. But let me talk a little bit about where China's headed in kind of broad macroeconomic terms and why they're doing what they're doing. I think the first observation is that it now seems clear, in fact, I've been arguing it for months, but now there's more data to support it, that China's the first major economy to get off the bottom, that its growth is recovering from the low point in the fourth quarter of last year, when they were probably growing at something like 0 to 1%, to something in the neighborhood of 5% growth compared to in the first quarter of this year compared to the fourth quarter of last year. So they are recovering, I think, obviously sooner than any other large economy. And what I want to talk about for a few minutes is why that is the case. And it's a combination of the nature of their policy response to the global financial crisis and the economic downturn and some structural factors of the Chinese economy which are working very strongly to their advantage in the current environment. But first, the stimulus. I think what I've been saying is the Chinese stimulus was early, well-designed, and large. It was early because it began in September of last year when China took a number of monetary policy measures to increase the availability of credit. They lowered interest rates. They reduced the reserve requirement that banks were subject to, which meant they didn't have to hold quite as much money at the central bank and would have more money to lend. And most importantly, the central bank got rid of the lending quotas that had restricted the quantity of funds that individual banks could lend. It was large. The stimulus package was large because this monetary stimulus was followed with the $586 billion investment stimulus package, largely financed through credit but somewhat financed through the budget that John mentioned a minute ago. And finally, it was well designed. It is not – well, it has fixed investment, which I think addresses real needs. For example, they're investing a great deal this year in the power grid, the State Grid Corporation, which is responsible for the grid in about 85% of China, is investing $250 billion to expand its capacity to move power around. In the previous 5 years, China invested massive amounts of money in building out the generating system, lots of money going into power generation, but they neglected to invest very much in the grid system. So they don't have a way of using the capacity very efficiently because it can't be moved around the country to respond to peak demand. Similarly, in the transportation sector, which is getting a lot of money, much, much more is going into the rail system as opposed to the road system, which has built out very substantially over the last few years. Another very important dimension of the program, the policy response, is that it includes a substantial increase in expenditures for social programs, for transfer payments, and so forth. In other words, this is not just building up more physical infrastructure from a massive investment program, but there are very substantial investments in human resources, in human capital, if you will, through substantial increases in educational expenditures, health care, and so forth. Pension payments are being increased very dramatically, which is another example of putting more money in the pockets of individuals so that consumption demand will contribute more significantly to economic growth than it has in the past. Pension payments, that is payments to people who are already retired and drawing a pension, have in the last 2 years been increased at twice the rate of inflation. So in the last 2 years, they've gone up 20%. Consumer price inflation over that period is up about 10%. So at the beginning of 2008 and again at the beginning of 2009, monthly pension payments increased by about 110 RMB per month at the beginning of this year. There are similar massive increases in payments to individuals who collect funds under the I can't remember exactly what it's called, the State Low Income Guarantee Program or something. If your income is below a certain level, you get certain amounts of money on a monthly basis as an income support program. The expenditures on that program have increased very substantially. So the social programs will help to reduce the precautionary demand for savings on the part of households, so consumers will feel comfortable spending a slightly higher share of their disposable income. The transfer payments will increase disposable income on the part of households, again, facilitating some increase in consumption expenditure. So it's not just adding to the physical infrastructure. So that's my view on the stimulus, early, well-designed, and large. And that certainly explains to a considerable degree why the Chinese economy has begun to recover already. But the three other factors of which I put under this label of structural features of the economy, which are also important in explaining why this stimulus program, in its various dimensions that I just went through, have worked relatively well. And they basically all build off this idea that China is a low-debt economy. And it's low debt whether you're looking at the household sector, the financial sector, or the government sector. And I'll start with households because I think that's something of immediate importance and something that we can relate to more readily. The basic idea here, of course, is that in the United States, households have massive amounts of debts compared to their income. Going into the crisis, household debt in the United States was about 130% of disposable income. Disposable income is just a fancy word for after-tax income. And in China, it's about 30%. So we're finding in the United States, in the aftermath of the crisis, people are saving more, either because they're trying to replace the value of lost assets, the decline in the value of their houses and their stock portfolios and so forth. Some people don't have access to credit anymore, so they are paying down their debt because they're paying on their previous credit and they can't get new credit. So one way or the other, U.S. households are saving more and spending less. The household savings rate has gone from about 0% in the middle of last year up to something close to 5% today. And that increase in the savings rate is the main reason our economy has slowed down so much, and particularly it explains a very large share of the absolute decline in U.S. GDP growth in the fourth quarter of last year, because household consumption is 70% of aggregate demand, and so when households actually start spending less, and I don't mean spending at a slower rate, I mean spending absolutely less, it's pretty hard to avoid having negative growth in total output. In the Chinese situation, where household debt is very modest, there is no need for deleveraging. People have not built their expenditures based on taking out more and more credit. Credit is as available or even more available than it was 6 months ago. So mortgage lending, for example, in the first quarter of this year to Chinese households is up quite significantly. So household expenditure has not suffered in the crisis in China. Household expenditure has kept growing and thus has contributed significantly to the growth of GDP. I mean, it is true household consumption as a share of GDP in China is relatively low, which is something I'll come back to, but the key point here in the short run is it's not declining. It's growing. It's continuing to grow in absolute terms. So the first structural feature is very little debt in the household sector compared to the United States, the UK, Ireland, Spain, and a lot of other countries that binged on debt over the last 5 years or so. The second difference is in the financial sector itself. China never had financial institutions that had balance sheets that were 25, 30, 35 times their capital, like the major investment banks in the United States going into the crisis. They're run very conservatively. The regulator has had a requirement that they maintain relatively large capital relative to the size of their assets. And so these institutions do not issue very much debt. Debt of financial institutions in China is about 15% of GDP. Debt of financial institutions in the United States is about 100% of GDP. Again, what difference does that make? Well, in the current environment, one of the reasons we're having very slow growth of lending is that most financial institutions are not in a position to lend very much money. Even though the government is providing a great deal of additional funding, they're having to write off assets at such a pace that it's extremely difficult to grow their balance sheets, i.e., increase their lending very significantly. So they are deleveraging. They're paying down debt. They're trying to build up their capital. They're shrinking the size of their balance sheets in order to bring their capital and assets more into balance. And that's one of the reasons that we see relatively slow growth of credit in the United States. And as I mentioned earlier, the monetary policy in China has really gotten traction because Chinese financial institutions don't need to shrink their balance sheets. They can grow their balance sheets very substantial. They have excess capacity, excess capital relative to the regulatory standard. The reserve requirement has been cut. They have a lot of liquidity. And thus, we can have a very substantial growth of credit in China, as we've seen over the last 6 months. Finally, the third element is the debt of the public sector. China, again, begins from a very good position. Its debt, public debt, as a share of GDP, was less than one-fifth. Going into the crisis in the United States, we were around 45, 50%. I can't remember exactly. But more importantly, in the crisis and for the next few years, the United States is obviously adding massively to its public debt at the rate of 10, 12, 13% of GDP per year. And by the way, GDP is going to be going down. So the ratio of debt to GDP is going up. And probably by the time we get out of the crisis, we're going to have public debt that's 80, 85% or more of GDP. 2 to 3 years from now, China is going to have public debt as a share of GDP that's probably going to be in the neighborhood of 25%. Their deficits are very small, 3% of GDP this year. They're growing probably at 7 or 8% this year. So the ratio of debt to GDP is will be very modest as they come out of the crisis more fully. Again, what difference does this make? It makes a big difference because in the United States, eventually, in order to reduce our debt to a sustainable level relative to GDP, we're going to have to either cut expenditures or increase taxes. This is the pledge that President Obama has made to reduce the deficit by the fourth year of his first term by 50%. That will require some very painful adjustments. He hasn't told us exactly where they'll be coming, but that will not, if we have to raise taxes in order to reduce the growth of our public deficit, that will obviously be adverse for growth. So this fiscal medium-term fiscal consolidation, as it's referred to, will probably not be helpful for growth. So the conclusion I draw from this is one I've made already, that is that China's first off the bottom. I also believe that China will probably be the first large economy to converge back towards its long-term potential growth. They're not going to have to raise taxes in order to control the growth of their public debt. So I think they have the capacity of getting back to long-term growth fairly quickly. The United States may come off the bottom by the end of the year, this year, or maybe early next year. But I think we'll have a subpar recovery because households will be deleveraging, financial institutions will be deleveraging, and 2 or 3 years out, we're going to have the adverse impact of higher taxes or lower government expenditures, which will be necessary to reduce the magnitude of our public debt relative to GDP to make it more sustainable. So I think the picture for China is obviously they're growing at a much slower rate. They were growing at 13% in 2007. They dropped down to single digits last year. They'll probably be in the neighborhood of 7 to 8% this year. So I don't want to give the impression, because I'm saying positive things, that China is not suffering. Their growth is down very dramatically, say from 13% to 7%. No other country that I'm aware of is losing 6 percentage points of economic growth on an annual basis. But having said that, I think their policy response has been pretty much the gold standard, and I think the structural features of their economy, which have to do with conservative financial practices for the most part, put them in a very strong position and make their stimulus package much, much more effective. It's getting a lot more traction, particularly on the monetary policy side. Well, having said that, we are talking today a bit about, if we look at the title again, China's relationship with the United States. I want to talk a little bit about the economic relationship with the United States and talk about four areas, briefly, of four areas in which I think we do share common interests. And these have to do with, first, promoting global economic recovery, secondly, promoting reform of major international financial institutions, thirdly, enhancing the role of the G20 in coordinating global economic policy, and finally, reducing global economic imbalances. Well, I think the first one's fairly obvious. The United States, among developed countries, has the largest stimulus package, according to the IMF, and China, according to the IMF, has the largest stimulus package among developing countries. So I think our first common interest is, again, to encourage other nations to follow our lead so that the prospects for an early and strong global recovery are maximized. And I think we've seen some of that. Since the G20 meeting in November, we have seen a few countries that have stepped up to the plate a little bit more and increased their stimulus packages or initiated stimulus packages where they had none before. Certainly Japan would be one example. Now, whether or not these actions are in a direct response to the United States and China, but I do think we're setting jointly a good example. I think both countries also have a strong shared interest in promoting fundamental reforms of major financial institutions like the World Bank and the IMF. China is clearly underrepresented, as is India and a number of other emerging markets. The United States, at least among advanced industrial nations, I think has been the most supportive of fundamental reform. After all, we already have a much smaller voting share than our economic footprint would indicate, and it's some of the European countries that don't want to make an adjustment. So I think the United States basically has been the strongest supporter of an expansion of the shares of China and other emerging markets, and so we have a common interest in pushing forward on that reform. On the G20, I think, again, we share a common interest. The United States has long, or at least for several years, wanted China to play the role of a responsible international stakeholder. And I think the attempts that were made in earlier periods to get China to participate in the G7 or G8 really didn't work out. It was a very uncomfortable environment for China, since it was the only emerging market that was included in the group most of the time or proposed as a permanent member. And so these ad hoc attempts didn't work out. I think by contrast, China is very comfortable in the G20. You have other emerging markets like India and Brazil and Indonesia. So China's not at risk of being forced into the situation where it's being held up to the standard of advanced high-income economies, but is in a grouping that includes a number of other emerging markets. So I think the United States, again, has supported the role of expanded role of the G20, and I think going forward we should work jointly to make the G20 an effective mechanism for coordinating global economic policy. Third one I'm going to mention is obvious, that is avoiding trade protectionism. We're the largest and the third largest global trading economy, so we certainly have the most to lose by any retrogression towards protectionism in the economic downturn. Both countries have supported this strongly in the two G20 meetings, leadership meetings that have occurred last fall and again in the London meeting, and I think we should work strongly in that vein again. And I would say, finally, we have strong common interest in reducing global economic imbalances. After all, Wen Jiabao said a couple of years ago, and this is a direct quote, we must reduce our unsustainably large trade imbalance or too large trade imbalance. That this has been a goal of the Chinese leadership for a number of years. And in the United States, we have recognized the disadvantages of running a large continuous global deficit for so many years. And I think we are making progress. I think both countries are making progress on that front. The United States global current account deficit peaked in 2006 at about 6% of GDP. It has come down. By 2008, it was down to 4.7% of GDP. Most forecasts for this year are for in the neighborhood of 3%. IMF is saying 2.8%. So we have had a reduction in our current account imbalance, certainly in part due to the fact that the dollar has depreciated significantly since its peak in February 2002. China, too, is moving in the direction of greater balance. Its global current account surplus was $372 billion in 2007. That's five times what it had been in 2004. So it went from about 3.6% of GDP up to 11% of GDP. But last year it only grew by about 15%, and it declined as a share of GDP down to 9.8%. So it's the slowest growth of their surplus in many years, and I think in 2009, for reasons we could discuss if anyone wants to get into the details, I think their current account surplus is likely to grow very little this year or perhaps even fall slightly. So, as I said, China, Wen Jiabao said we must reduce our excessively large trade imbalance, and since we were kind of mirror images of a growing U.S. global deficit and growing Chinese surplus, and these imbalances were certainly a contributory factor to the global financial crisis, I think we have a common shared objective in gradually reducing these balances. It can't be reduced immediately, but over time, the two countries are moving towards adjustment through changes in savings behavior and so forth. So I think we're making progress. I think we have a lot of shared common interests, and I think China will be the first country to converge back towards long-term economic growth. Let me stop there and turn it over to Charles. Oh, and I just want to show you this.
Yeah,
this
sure
is the book, China's Rise, which was published late last year.
Let me repeat that for those of you who didn't hear. In your packet, there is information about how to pick up your very own copy of China's Rise, which has lots of good Nick Lardy material, and some from the rest of us as well, including Fred Bergston, who had to be talked off the ledge and asked not to trump the G2 argument so heavily. I'm going to talk a little bit about sort of the policy side of things and really kind of the lessons and takeaways that China in particular has gained from the experiences of the past 9-10 months. And really, if you are familiar with the five stages of growth, there's sort of the five stages of Chinese recovery. The initial one, which was shock that as Wang Qishan said last summer, that the teacher seems to have fallen down on the lessons, and the student may have learned more than the teacher, and that suddenly the U.S. model, which if China never really held up as its own model, certainly held up as an ideal, and even though the China never subscribe to the Washington Consensus, there was always this idea that the 10-point program of the Washington Consensus really was the gold standard, to use Nick's phrase, for how do you should organize your economy. And it was really shocking to watch the United States fall down the way it did for the Chinese. That was followed up very quickly by triumphalism, in which the blogosphere went wild, particularly in the wake of the Olympics, and declared that the United States' fall was loss was China's gain. That's this proved that China was maybe there really was need for a Beijing consensus to replace the Washington consensus, that the China model was inherently superior. The Chinese polity was more nimble than democracy, and this proved that all was right in Beijing. Followed up very quickly thereafter by nervousness that even though the model may have been superior in their view, the fact was the beauty of the responsible stakeholder policy had created stakes for China that really tied it to the rest of the world and didn't allow its model to exist in a vacuum. And nervousness over the fact in particular that many of its, if not all of its assets, were denominated in U.S. dollars, something that, as one Chinese economist said to me, a lot of us went out and read everything that Ben Bernanke had ever written on how you fix fix economy in recession, and we all learned that the consistent view was you print money. And that made us extremely nervous, because that meant something very specific for the value of our assets overseas. And then there was the nervousness, though, was really followed, and I think they're not precise stages, of course, but it was followed up by sort of raw determination. And the traps were taken off the money supply, credit was loosed, as Nick described, and. The stimulus package was unveiled with extraordinary rapidity and with, as Nick suggests, a certain degree of success. And the final stage in which China's currently seems to be is they've declared victory and they're hoping for the best. And that's really where I think we find ourselves. Now, Nick talked about the gold standard of China's stimulus. There is an alternative view here, and I'm not an economist, so I get to butcher this, but just so you're aware, I mean there are a number of economists out there that suggest that the recovery is illusory, that this is temporary, this is equivalent to putting a bunch of fertilizer in a pond and watching an algae bloom. As soon as you remove the fertilizer, the algae stops blooming. Suggestions that the credit going into large state-owned enterprises, in particular, as part of the stimulus, is one, creating a significant problem of non-performing loans down the road, and B, creating opportunities for rather silly investment patterns by some of the Chinese enterprises in roads to nowhere and bridges to nowhere and malls in the middle of nowhere. Some economists have quoted individual companies as saying, we don't know what we're going to do with this big check, but we're glad to have it and we're going to spend it. So that doesn't necessarily lend itself to an effective recovery, but as Nick said, and Nick will caution those of us non-economists, these individual data points mean absolutely nothing when painted against the broad picture of China's effective stimulus. And since Nick is my rabbi in these matters, I defer to him, as always. There are a couple things about the stimulus that we should keep in mind, and it was very nimble the way they rolled it out. But in part, they got really lucky. In part, China has been preparing for the last 6 years or so to deal with these dislocations and regional disparities as a result of 30 years of runaway growth. And so a lot of what they had planned to do with respect to the grid, with respect to social safety nets, was to try to reduce some of these disparities and thereby reduce some of the social instability that they had seen crop up over the last decade or so. So in many respects, a lot of the projects that were rolled out as part of the stimulus had already been in the works for some time, both to manage social instability and to create more a national Chinese economy, to break down regional monopolies, to connect the provinces more directly through roads and rails. So the fact was that this was in the pipeline, and the tremendous success, I think, is of the stimulus is in the fact that they realized and they needed to pivot on a dime and roll it out really rather on an accelerated basis. And so they've done that. We'll see whether there are some downsides to that. But clearly it's been it's been remarkable to see it in action. And, you know, there's for those of you who export to China in the room, you already are seeing an uptick in demand, including not just demand for commodities, which you'd expect when you're spending this massive amount on infrastructure, but you're seeing demand and sustainable demand, apparently, in some consumer durables. So now some will argue that that's as a result of trying to get the farmers to buy TVs and so forth, and there's something to that. But the fact of the matter is that the recovery in exports to China in production, particularly in markets in Asia, looks to be something more than just a restoration of inventories that were drawn down in the last quarter of 2008. So there really does appear that if China hasn't already bottomed out, it's coming to the bottom very quickly. That does not mean, of course, that China is necessarily an engine for global growth. And those around the world that are chomping at the bit saying, at last now we have a market for our exports, are almost certainly going to be somewhat disappointed, if not very disappointed. There is, for one thing, the demand in China would have to go up rather astronomically to even come close to the loss of demand that we have seen and will likely see for the foreseeable future from the United States. Nick quoted the 130% of household income in debts, which versus 30% in China. You're not going to get to a balance of 70-70, or even if you did, I'm not sure that would bring other export markets back into exporters back into recovery to where they were before. The other thing to remember is that for most of the past decade, the United States GDP, 72% or up to 72% of U.S. GDP has been composed of consumption, whereas a more normal rate would be around 60%. And that 70% is almost certainly going to come down. So the United States is not likely to come back to normal anytime soon either. But beyond the simple fact that it's unlikely, given the makeup of the Chinese economy, that it's going to be a driver for global growth, we've seen in the last 6 years, well, 8 years in particular, since the end of the WTO accession period, that the whole process by which China really has risen economically over the first 30 years of its growth period, or the first 25 years of its growth period, in some respects has been beaten back. I mean, China, since 1978, the way that growth really started was by the Chinese government getting out of the way and allowing individual farmers to grow crops and therefore and profit from the money they made themselves, gradually sort of roll back a series of state controls that removed the Chinese government from active management of the day-to-day economy. In the last 8 years in particular, there's been a rolling back again of some of those market reforms, and you've seen the rise of industrial policy in areas that are particularly problematic for those of us that believe in the power of free markets, but also for those of us that worry about the impact of industrial policies and the inevitable trade protectionism in China on trade frictions between the United States and China. I should say in that context that I'm not saying that the United States is blameless. There's a lot of policies here in this country that are going on that about which we should be fairly embarrassed as far as protectionism. But certainly, the China is not blame free either. For one thing, if you look one of the real dangers of the current stimulus, and again the triumphalism, or at least the perception that China's that it has. Its model is superior to that of the United States. One of the real challenges is that this industrial policymaking, which seems, again, to be skewed towards state-owned enterprises and towards creating pillar and strategic industries to the exclusion of the small and medium-sized, more private companies along the coast in the Zhejiang provinces and Jiangsu provinces and the like, which have really been the driver of much of Chinese economic growth for a period of time, and certainly driver of employment, These smaller companies are being ignored, and the state-owned enterprises are being championed and pushed forward as a kind of China's economic future. This is a worry, and not just for the for U.S. U.S. and other competition, but really for the Chinese economy, because these are not these are not efficient enterprises. And if you spent any time talking to the management of state-owned enterprises, you'll know that they are not particularly motivated by a bottom line. There's a lot of emphasis on you know, how much what quantity of steel consumption we'll have. And there's a very different metric rather than profit and loss. And it's so if you're thinking the future of Chinese enterprises or Chinese economy are these SOEs, pillar and strategic industries, I think there's a lot of downside there. But again, that's where most of the credit is flowing into. You know, we've heard a lot in the context particularly of the Buy America provision of the U.S. stimulus, in which China and other countries really scored some knockout rhetorical blows against the United States. The Chinese government in particular has said there is no Buy China provision in the Chinese stimulus package. The reality is that that's not true at all. And in fact, if you look at not only the national stimulus package, there are very clear preferences for Chinese produced goods and services. But once you get down to the local and provincial level, there are fiat, more than just simply preferences, demands for Chinese goods and services. And that again, creates a problem. We are entering a period in which we are speaking on a very grand rhetorical level, both the presidents and the senior leadership of both countries, about the need to avoid protectionism. But in practice, we're getting protectionism in spades. There was an article, I mean, again, it's not just China's not purely at fault here. Ambassador Hills was talking earlier to us about reminding us that on a local level here, there's a tremendous amount of, at a state level, there's a tremendous amount of protectionism in the stimulus package. And it is a significant worry. And so the question, I think, becomes, if you've got a China which, as a result of the lessons they've learned, i.e. that perhaps the U.S. model is not the be-all and end-all of existence, that has returned in significant part to a reliance on planning or at least industrial policymaking as a tool of economic development, and that is for rather obsessively focused on internal issues, internal challenges, whether it's the dislocations and disparities we talked about or political instability. It's very difficult in this environment for the U.S. to exercise the kind of leadership, to the moral or other leadership, to try to make sure that China really, perhaps using the word responsible stakeholder, is tired at this point, but that China really plays a leadership, powerful, and maybe even G2-type role in bringing the world, the global recovery. I want to stop using the word G2 because I think it doesn't exist. It shouldn't exist as a formal concept, although in practice it seems that both administrations are focusing a lot on cooperation with each other as a means of managing global affairs. That said, I think Nick is absolutely right. There are four areas that we do have common interests are, and one is promoting recovery. Second is promoting a reform of global institutions of global governance. Third is emphasizing the G20. You know, there may be other more preferable formulations, but I doubt we're going to get to them in any near term. So the G20 is the surviving entity that really is going to be, I think, the engine of, or excuse me, the organ for global recovery, and then reducing imbalances. All of those are very, very difficult because all of those involve intense domestic political challenges. And so I do think it's going to require a tremendous amount of leadership in Beijing and in Washington by a really refusal to listen to the naysayers on Capitol Hill. I see you back there. And in the corridors of Zhongnanhai, don't look back there. I'm joking. And in the corridors of Zhongnanhai, that would otherwise seek to protect domestic constituencies against the interests of the greater good. I will stop there and say with one caveat. One of the things that the areas of that both governments have identified as a matter of area of common interest is energy and climate change issues. And I think it's going to be very interesting as the two get closer and closer and begin to have more intensified discussions whether that really is an area of common interest or whether the domestic politics will intervene there in ways that make some of the other issues we're talking about seem somewhat simple. Thank you.
Well, it certainly implies a degree of realignment. Whether or not it falls into the fundamental camp, I'm not quite sure. But I think what will happen is the savings rate in China will come down. Some of that will be because corporates save less in the coming period with slower economic growth. The government is beginning to dissave a little bit as opposed to save as it did in the past. And maybe even the household savings rate will come down. So all three of those things potentially could move in the right direction over the next few years and make their global current account surplus smaller. So they're already the world's biggest creditor, but maybe that the growth of those external credits would slow significantly over the next few years. The U.S., I see much more dimly, probably because I spend no time on it, so I shouldn't even talk about it. But I don't see any forecasts that show the U.S. current account deficit going back to 6% of GDP. We obviously have a very large government deficit. It's going to require a massive increase in financing and the sale of treasury bonds and so forth. But for the most part, these are going to be sold domestically. Our need to finance an external deficit, as I mentioned before, has come down substantially since 2006, and I think will continue to be low, even lower than in this year than it was last year. So that's why I do see some degree of convergence. China will be maybe a less large global surplus country, and we are becoming a less large global deficit country. I think that should be very, very positive for the overall economic relationship because it means that, you know, this contribution of huge excess consumption in the United States and huge excess savings in China will be alleviated. So we'll need to borrow less from China. They'll need to lend less to the rest of the world. China will have a growth path that will be somewhat more dependent on its own domestic consumption demand, less dependent on the growth of its exports. We will have a growth path that will be built more on domestic savings and less domestic consumption and a smaller external deficit. I think that should be positive for each individual country, and I think also for the global economy, because global economic imbalances can contribute to financial disequilibrium, as we have seen over the last couple of years.
You talked about domestic consumption as being what China wants to promote. My understanding is that over the last 4 or 5 years, this has been a goal, and in fact, the percentage of GDP that is domestic consumption has not decreased, has not increased, I'm sorry. Why are these moves that they're making now different, and why do you think that they will work better than what's happened over the past few years?
Well, no, Doug, you're absolutely right. This has been an explicit policy goal since Central Party Work Conference in December of 2004. They began to take some very cautious steps in 2005 and 2006 to encourage domestic consumption, but basically they didn't move strongly enough in any of the policy domains where I think action is required. For example, they had very little appreciation of their currency in 2006. In 2007, their currency on a trade-weighted basis actually depreciated, so their goods were becoming more competitive. In terms of increased social outlays to rebuild the social safety net so that households would be not feel they had to save 25% of their income, again, in 2005 and 2006, the growth of all social expenditures was in the mid-teens. In the last 2 years, it's been close to 30% per year. The currency, as I mentioned before, has appreciated much more rapidly in 2008 than it did in the earlier period. So at least in some domains, they're moving more rapidly. In part, you know, this is a big economy that takes a while to turn. In part, they're under a lot more pressure now. I think there's a greater recognition of the need to change the underlying growth model, that they're not going to be able to rely so much on the growth of their external surplus to generate demand. So in part, you could say they have the benefit of having made the appropriate decision 5 years ago or almost five, 4.5 years ago, and they took some of the foundation steps. Now they're moving more quickly. But in part, it's because the reality has changed and the external market has looks softer. And if the United States moves in the directions we were just talking about, the, you know, the United States is not going to be a big source of – it will still be a source, but not as big a source of demand for Chinese goods as it was for most of this decade.
Secretary Geithner is set to go leave for China, I think.
Treasury Secretary Geithner is heading to China next week for
– Saturday. He's leaving Saturday, actually.
Saturday. What messages on the economy and in his portfolio do you think he must deliver to the Chinese, or what are the key issues that he should raise at this point in both the U.S. recovery and stimulus implementation and China's recovery and stimulus implementation? And for a little bit of inside baseball, you know, Secretary Clinton's trip earlier in the year was viewed very favorably by both the Chinese and the U.S., other than a few human rights not groups that were disappointed with her lack of discussion of those issues. What does Secretary Geithner, as her co-chair in the Strategic and Economic Dialogue, need to do in order to get that same credibility with the Chinese? What should he avoid doing, or what must he deliver on in order to have the same positive reaction in both capitals?
You want to go first?
Sure. I don't think the Chinese are as nervous about Secretary Geithner as they were earlier in the administration when he issued comments during the course of, or written comments during the course of his confirmation hearing, calling China a currency manipulator and making some other comments that suggested that he wasn't really fully focused on some of the issues. So I think they are more confident. What does he have to say? I think he has to talk about the importance of a strong dollar to get the Chinese to feel comforted. I'm not sure how firmly he can make that pledge. But I think that's the key message he has to send to the Chinese. You know, he's got to keep focusing on exchange rate regime reform. I mean, that really it's critical for China. And without that, I think a lot of the things that Nick is talking about are really whistling Dixie. So, there are ways to put it which don't make the United States seem like a village preacher or seem like we're in China's face. But it's also got to be said fairly firmly that, you know, to the extent that China really does believe it's getting out of the export-led growth business and into the consumption-led growth business, currency reform is a big part of that. And to the extent we're going to have discussions on restoring imbalances or relieving imbalances, that's job one.
Thank you. Ernie Prieg, a Manufacturers Alliance, so obviously I'm interested in the manufacturing sector. Which is very grim here, incidentally, Nick. We came out a report yesterday, industrial production down over 20% this year is the projection. So I'm interested in just where is Chinese manufacturing industry going as they come back, and particularly their exports, which have been growing a little bit in the last couple of months. And the good news, if any, for the U.S. point of view and trade and manufacturers in the first quarter, our exports are down, our imports are down, but also our trade deficit's way down. It's down considerably. Except for China, for some reason in the first quarter, the U.S. deficit with China in manufacturers is larger this year than last year, even though everything's down. In fact, the share of the U.S. deficit in manufacturers the first quarter of this year with China, it rose from about half last year to 75% of our global deficit this first quarter was with China. And we're now at a ratio of more than 7 to 1. We import more than 7 times as much as we export, which makes it extremely difficult to reduce the deficit. We would have to export more than our export growth would have to grow by more than 70% if our imports grew 10%, if you follow my numbers. So I'm just not sure where it's going myself. I try to keep in touch. But, Nick, what's happening in the manufacturing industry, particularly the export sector?
China's domestic manufacturing, of course, is the hardest hit component of their economy. Well, you have GDP growth going from 13% down to 9-point-something percent last year, probably something closer to 7-8% this year. So GDP growth is down by almost half probably this year. But manufacturing is down proportionately a great deal more. I mean, we saw over the long-term path has been manufacturing in China has been growing year after year after year at 17, 18. I mean, how do you, you know, agriculture in China never grows more than about 2 or 3%, maybe in a great year, 3.5. I don't remember exactly. But in order to get the whole economy moving ahead at double-digit rates, you have to have a manufacturing sector that's pulling it ahead. And so it's been growing at, you know, not 20%, but not too shy of 20% per year, year after year. Now, you know, in April it was growing at 7%. In March it was growing at 8%. So manufacturing growth is down by more than half. So it's pretty hard hit. And certain parts of it are much harder hit than others. Obviously, the basic materials and the investment goods are down more than some of the consumer goods because consumption demand has held up reasonably well, as I mentioned before. So that part of manufacturing, I haven't looked at the highly disaggregated numbers, but that part of manufacturing is probably less substantially hit.
My name is Susan Weld from Georgetown Law Center. And one of the reasons one couldn't put as much money into solving the problem in the hard-hit areas as one wanted to was it was like putting water in a bucket with a lot of holes in. The structure wasn't there to spend the money in a reasonable and rational way. And I'm wondering whether the government itself will have trouble in the social spending it's trying to do in getting, for example, health spending out. There's no real structure there to do that. Does anybody, do you have any thoughts on that? Is that really going to be a problem, or are you confident that they'll be able to get their domestic consumption up by these efforts they're doing in social welfare and so on?
Well, there are two dimensions of this. One is what's actually being delivered in terms of health care, which I think is the question you're talking about. But the second dimension, which is also important, is who's paying for it. And it's easier to handle the second problem than it is to handle the first problem. And a lot of what's being done today is changing who's paying for it. The share of healthcare expenditures paid out of pocket by consumers, households reached a peak of 60% in 2001, and it is now gradually coming down, and I believe it'll come down even more substantially over the next few years. So you put into effect these insurance schemes, and remember the new program that they launched in April of this year, March of this year, is designed to bring 400 million more people into the insurance scheme. And that means that the source of financing for the health care is switching from individuals to the government. And I think they certainly have the capacity to do that. And in part, it's happening because the central government is paying for a much, much larger share. Traditionally, central government paid for less than 5% of health and education expenditures, even up until recent years. Now, the portion that's being paid for centrally is getting up towards 30-40% of incremental expenditures. On the second issue, how much health care services are actually being delivered, I do think there's a very substantial program underway. The 850 billion RMB that they promised to spend in this year through 2011 has a very substantial build-out of, you know, clinics in township and village levels, county-level hospitals, and so at least that part of the health infrastructure program should improve quite substantially. Obviously, it's a longer lead time to train more doctors and qualified medical personnel of one sort or another, but I think they're doing better on the changing who pays, but gradually they're also addressing the question of how they'll actually be able to deliver more health services.
You're absolutely right. I mean, the challenge of producing a really adequate delivery mechanism for healthcare is years off, and so you're absolutely right that it's a long term goal, and there are fundamental incentive structures built into the medical industry that make it that much more difficult. It's one of the reasons that we think we should be realistic about China's internal focus. I mean, they are not going to be as interested in saving the world or being a member of the G2 or a global leader. They're going to be focused on their own domestic problems, which are significant. Corruption, center-local problems, and I think just generally the problem when you have any sort of command economy come back into action as quickly as it has been. I mean, I do think to that latter point, I think the question of whether or not the tremendous amount of credit that's been kept put into the system, whether that's been efficient or not, is a really important one. I think, one can argue, and Nick does very persuasively, that there's so much money being spent out there that even if a relatively significant portion of that goes into silly projects or inefficient projects or for corrupt uses, that still allows a very large amount of money to be spent in ways that will create greater competitiveness in China. Still, it's something to worry about. All of us who've been into China know that there's a difference between what Beijing wants and what Wenzhou is going to do. So, they've declared victory on the stimulus, and they're crossing their fingers that Wenzhou is going to do what they should do. But I think that's a significant challenge.
I'd say a couple of things that are obvious. One is the pace of global recovery. I don't think China's going back to the big export-led growth model in which their trade surplus is growing by, $250 or $300 billion a year. But they do need to have more robust external demand than they do today. If exports continue to fall by 25% month after month, and that continues all the way into 2010, then I think their recovery will be at risk. The unemployment problems will worsen and so forth, and it will be very hard to get a lot of private domestic demand going. In other words, we have a lot of government-led investment demand right now, but there are huge chunks of this economy where there's no investment going on because nobody with two brains would invest a penny because you can't even absorb your existing capacity given the collapse of your export market. So if global recovery, for whatever reason, is substantially delayed beyond what most people think it will be, if the U.S. does not begin to come out in 2009 and Europe's recovery is delayed until after 2010, then I think it will be much tougher for the Chinese to converge back towards what I call their long-term potential growth. The second factor that I would point to is, in terms of a shortcoming or a risk, is the domestic property market. One of the reasons China started slowing down long before the global economy slowed down, and remember, they started slowing down after the second quarter of 2007, so, they're now into 2 years, basically, of slowdown, was because the property market started to slow down. Part of that was policy-induced, and part of it was not. But throughout 2007, and particularly 2008, property sales were down, inventories of unsold property were building. And we've seen some recovery, in part because the monetary stimulus that started in September of last year reduced interest rates and reduced the payments required on down payments required for mortgages and a number of other specific steps that were designed to increase the demand for housing. And housing sales are now picking up, at least in the first 3 or 4 months of this year, housing sales have picked up somewhat. But new starts, that is, new housing coming under construction for the first time, has not yet recovered. It's still down significantly. So developers appear to be waiting to see whether or not they can reduce their inventories more before they start new housing construction. So if the new housing construction doesn't kick in, sometime in the second half of the year, then obviously it's going to be much tougher for China to achieve the kind of growth rates that it's talking about. Certainly 8% will be extremely difficult, if not impossible. So number one risk is delayed, significantly delayed external recovery. Number two is failure for of the stimulus to lead to a fuller recovery in the domestic housing market. Now, just since Charles has already advertised what good arguments I have, I will say that I am not so worried about too much of the stimulus money, particularly the credit, going into state-owned companies, because the amount of credit that's going into manufacturing companies is extremely small, particularly when you look at medium and long-term credit, which is the money that's used to finance investment. In the first quarter of this year, when the incremental lending was very large, only 7.9% of the medium and long-term loans went to manufacturing. So, yes, state companies, like the state grid that I mentioned before, it's 100% state-owned company. It's not a listed company. The state just owns it lock, stock, and barrel with no no gloss of anything else. They're getting a lot of money. And on the other hand, steel companies, other metal companies, copper, aluminum, cement, I don't believe those companies, which are the heart of the manufacturing sector, are getting very much credit to expand capacity. I'm not sure any of those firms really want much money to expand capacity because their production is down. They already have excess capacity given the slump, substantial slump in economic growth, and particularly the downturn in construction. So, yes, the money is going to state-owned companies, but they are in infrastructure areas like the power grid, the railroads, which are certainly 100% lock, stock, and barrel owned by the state. It's going into municipal infrastructure, which by definition is municipally controlled and owned, water companies, water treatment companies, sewage companies, so forth, all the urban metro systems, again, all owned by the cities in which those are government entities of one sort or another. In those municipalities that build and run those subway systems. So it's going to the state, but it's not very little of the long-term money, very little of the long-term credit is going to manufacturing companies. So I don't think China's building up excess capacity. So I'm not sure I believe in this analogy about the fertilizer and the algae. Just pass it.
Well, you've both given I'm Carla Hills. You've both given a very good explanation of some of the problems that we face, and they're thorny, managing the global recovery, getting the imbalance in place. I'd like you to each express how do we manage the bilateral relationship going forward, and whether you think that the administration's announcement of the strategic and economic dialogue, which starts this summer with a plenary session of, I guess you're going to have a very large hall to bring everyone together, is really going to work, particularly when it's only held annually. And so what are your views about how we get our hands around these issues? Charles, you talked about the triumphalism of the Chinese. And they announced yesterday or the day before that if we want anything to do with climate change, we're going to have to do it all first, and the emerging economies will wait and see. I'm simplifying a bit.
Not much. That's right. How do we handle the Chinese? Well, sort of get our heads around this. I mean, the first thing is we still have a fundamental strategic mistrust between the two sides. And whatever you can say about the previous administration and the former president, he and the administration worked very, very hard to establish at least a level of personal trust between the president and President Hu. And I think that's job one, is to establish that level of trust so that when President Hu picks up the phone and President Obama says, this is what's going to happen, that President Hu can come and tell the assembled leadership in Beijing, this is what the Americans are going to do. If you can't do that, then the rest is absolutely, it's a waste of time. The rest follows from that. But the strategic and economic dialogue, You've presaged my answer. Thank you. The I'm not sure that it's an effective way to really organize U.S.-China involvement. I mean, yes, we've sort of gotten used to the notion that we need an umbrella of that brings the two interagency processes together, creates in China an interagency process that allows traditional silos to break down, and so that policy matters can be attended to at the table. It's very, very difficult, realistically, as you know better than any of us, to actually in these group sessions to accomplish anything substantive. Yes, there are preparatory meetings that take place throughout the course of the year that lead up and report to this umbrella organization. But at the end of the day, really, there's a limit to what you can accomplish at any one of these large sessions. I mean, you're going to have one or two big accomplishments, and you know, then you're going to agree to talk about the rest of them. We're at a stage now where we need more than one or two accomplishments a year. So I think it's going to be incumbent on the president, I think, to ultimately, both presidents, to bless dialogues that take place even among agencies in a way that allows decisions to be taken in both countries that allow policies to move forward. That's very difficult to do.
Just very briefly, I've been skeptical about this new arrangement for some time, but since that's the way they're going to go, I guess that's what we'll see. It doesn't line up very well with the Chinese side, so I think it creates a lot of problems for compared to the previous arrangement. I think it creates a lot of problems for the Chinese bureaucracy. They're trying to work around them by structuring this meeting in various ways that will try to minimize that, but I think it remains to be seen how well it will work, particularly on something like climate change. I think that was in Wang Qishan's portfolio, not in Dai Bingguo's. It's still in his portfolio, but with the Secretary of State on our end taking over the lead on that issue, it creates a mismatch, and they'll have to do some workarounds. How successful they'll be, we'll have to wait and see. I think, as your question implies, there are already such a vast gulf between us substantively that the fact that our bureaucratic arrangements on this issue in the dialogue are not optimal may turn out to be the least of our problems, but we'll see.
Just one follow-up. I have to say also that I think it's very that the JC, the Joint Commission on Commerce and Trade, is a very important piece of this puzzle here. I remember a lot of our policies, both here and in Beijing, are dictated by political considerations, and the administration inevitably reacts to foment coming off the hill, and that fomentation is going to come up on trade issues as much as anything else, as opposed to these larger strategic questions. And so I do think it's important that we have a vehicle to manage trade frictions, which is separate and independent from, but also given the full political imprimatur from on high, that is empowered to fix trade problems so that they don't gum up the works of the larger strategic relationship.
Thank you. I'm Rich Cronin with the Stimson Center. I guess mainly for Chaz, there's a question of, and anyone else wants to try it, it's just a question of if China doesn't achieve the kind of growth that people keep saying it needs for political stability, what are the prospects for the Chinese leadership itself? I mean, I know a lot of people address the issue of whether, in your volume, your outlook, you address the issue of local unrest or unrest and that sort of thing. But what about the leadership itself? I mean, it seems like some of the criticisms that have come from both Wen and Hu have been aimed at kind of covering their backsides for criticism, and they want to push the blame on us for mismanaging the economy, et cetera. And so is there something that might go on or might happen at the top level if the things look as negative as they are?
I can't see there being a leadership change before 2012 under any circumstances. I mean, I also want to say that you know, even at the highest levels of the Chinese Mandarinate on the economic side, when they talk about, oh, we need to achieve 8% growth in order to employ 50,000 people a day and therefore keep stability in place, that's a very simplistic and it's somewhat alarming analysis when you say, well, where has growth really come in the last few years? And it hasn't come from high employment-driven sectors. I mean, energy-intensive goods in particular have been a major driver of economic growth for the last few years. That they don't employ anybody. So I do worry that there's this sort of, you know, back-of-the-envelope calculation. As far as local unrest, I think, you know, the real trick that people are focusing on is less, you know, the, what is it, 50 million, 100 million, however many tens of millions of migrant workers have been displaced by the collapse of the manufacturing sector in China. I think that the leadership is much more fundamentally concerned about those 6 million college graduates that enter the job market and won't have a place to go fairly soon. You know, and I don't know if any of you have had the opportunity to meet with members of the Chinese government who have come through and tried to explore AmeriCorps and other ways that we keep our young people off the street. But that's a big challenge. As you know, I mean, the college grads are typically the source of genuine political instability as opposed to local unrest. So,
do you trust the numbers? There was just a spat between the Statistics Bureau and the International Energy Agency that said you can't be growing so fast if your energy consumption is going down, putting more money in state enterprises who will achieve whatever targets they're told to achieve in this victory. How does one trust the numbers? Is some better than others?
Well, I think the only safe thing to say is that the quality of the numbers is variable. Some of them are accurate but not particularly useful for analytical purposes. The Chinese concept of unemployment, for example, has in the denominator only the permanent urban residents. So if 20 million temporary workers in construction or manufacturing who have migrated from the countryside lose their jobs, the unemployment rate remains unchanged. So they had to do a special survey to find out how many jobs have been lost as a result of that. So some numbers are maybe accurate but not analytically useful because of the definition. But I think most of the data coming out of China are as good as and perhaps even better than data coming out from similar developing countries. I think the GDP numbers are, you know, get revised as they do in other countries from time to time, but I think are basically accurate. I think the price numbers are accurate. I think the financial data, in particular the data on the money supply and the amount of new loans and credit outstanding and things like that, I think I've never had any reason to doubt that those are not hard things to measure, and they do have a central bank that can keep track of what's going on. So I think the numbers are pretty accurate. I think IEA is basically wrong on what it said yesterday. It's perfectly understandable why electric power consumption is going down, even while GDP growth is recovering a bit. It's the same answer I gave to Ernie earlier. When you have the most energy-intensive sectors shrinking, steel production has declined in several recent months and is probably the single most. I mean, keep in mind the structure of demand for energy in China is very different from the United States. Almost all demand for energy in China is from industry. There's very little demand from transportation, and there's very so it's mostly industry as opposed to households or transportation. And as a result, when you have a few key, very energy-intensive sectors suffering an absolute decline in output like steel, it leaves a big hole in the demand for electric power, and electric power output goes down. But, you know, we saw this. The same thing happened back in the late 90s when they slowed down. Energy production slowed down quite a bit more. If anything, the Chinese economy is even more capital-intensive today than it was 10 years ago, given the nature of economic growth over the last 10 years. Remember, in the last slowdown, China's producing 100 million tons of steel. Now their production capacity is 550 million tons. So that's just one example. There would be comparable examples across a fairly broad range of very energy-intensive industries, including aluminum, cement, and so forth. So the tight relationship between kind of headline growth and electric power demand is gone. A lot now you have to dig beneath the surface and look at the structure of demand and to see how much various industries are going rather than just looking at the headline number that captures everything. So I happen to think the energy International Energy Agency made a big mistake when it said it doesn't trust the numbers.
Yes, I'm Terry Murphy. I'm the chairman of an international trade, mostly export controls consultancy, but I also get to help play at CSIS as a senior associate. I was in China several years ago. I was the only member of either country who was not a member of the government in a class photo at a major conference right after the airplane went down. My expertise, to the extent I have any, is that of a sort of long ago and far away former junior officer of the U.S. Navy. So I'm sort of picking up on Ambassador Hill's earlier comment about linking strategic and economic questions, and I realize this may be unfair to our economic experts at this outstanding presentation. I have to say, when I was in China that first time, I thought about G2. I think you sort of pulled that back a little bit, but it certainly looked like a G2 group at that time. Since then, looking at other things, maybe that not looked at by the economists, you can see the Chinese building an attack fleet. You can see the Chinese not allowing our storm-beaten small craft into Hong Kong harbor. You can see the Chinese pushing at our logistics survey ships, which are part of the U.S. Navy. And this very month, the month of May 2009, the front page cover of the United States Naval Institute Proceedings magazine shows a lurid picture of a big battleship aircraft carrier under severe attack, flaming, possibly sinking, et cetera. In other words, right out of World War II. So that's what the United States military is thinking about. That's the lead intellectual magazine for naval and other matters in the United States military, and that's this month. They're starting to think about what the Chinese are saying in their own academic, military academic magazines and institutes about us. And I would have thought that as of yesterday, with nuclear issues coming up in Asia, perhaps not with the Chinese, obviously, it's not a fair question because you're not really briefed, as they say, for this, but how do we interact between the very legitimate economic interests that you've so ably stated and the broader question that Ambassador Hills has put, and how do you relate that to the strategic interests? Thank you for your patience.
Well, one of the interesting things about the strategic and economic dialogue is there's no talk of having anybody from the People's Liberation Army at the tables. There should be. We are talking about relationships between the governments writ large, and we don't, despite the best efforts of many on both sides, we don't really have a substantive military-to-military dialogue to speak of. It's still at a very fairly superficial level. Talked about strategic mistrust. And I think that's it. There's nowhere that's nowhere more obvious than in the military region. Now, the picture in the aircraft carrier being bombarded, actually a similar picture appeared, I think, 5 years ago in a Chinese military. So I mean, it was too hot to touch here in this country. We're not even going to the fact that they've brought this to the future is very interesting. Look, China's growing. There's no question that China's military will grow along with it. China has interests which may or may not be directly coincident with ours. This is kind of inevitable. It's a process that needs to be managed, and I think managed with we've got to develop metrics and means to manage it sooner rather than later. If we are going to a period of dramatic instability on the Korean Peninsula, what does that mean? I mean, if you look, for example, at a period of where the North Korean government falls apart, the United States military will want to go in and secure weapons of mass destruction. How do we do that without a dialogue with the Chinese? Are we going to race to that? Is there going to be a race to the WMD with the Chinese? I mean, the fact that we don't have a very comprehensive dialogue with the Chinese military about Korea, it should be deeply disturbing to anybody who follows these issues. I'm not saying that we're going to reach some sort of accommodation or condominium with the Chinese on military affairs, but at least we have to begin to understand each other's both strategic intentions and what we're doing tactically.